My name is Eric Slife with SalesTrainingCentral.com. Our seminar today is Discovering Your Prospect's Pain, presented by Michael Nick, President and Founder of ROI for Sales. Michael provides consulting services for sales process reengineering. His primary business objective is to create credible and objective value estimation tools for sales, marketing, and executive management. He has trained thousands of sales personnel on ROI selling. They have delivered ROI selling modules to companies of all sizes, from startups to many Fortune 50 companies and into many different sectors of the market. Would you please welcome Michael Nick?
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate it. Before we begin, I want to make a couple of things clear to everyone. The first thing is that the information I'm going to talk about is really relevant for somebody selling complex B2B solutions. It could be software, it could be hardware, it could be consulting, something that's more complex than the usual consumer type purchases. So that's the first point I wanted to make. The second is that, bear with me, the beginning of this process is a little difficult. We're going to walk through a lot of steps. In my first book, ROI Selling, I spent 9 chapters on the concepts that I'm going to spend about 20 minutes teaching you on. So it's real important that you bear with me for a little while here. And I promise we'll get to the really good stuff around half-hour point or 20-minute point. I'll try to name the slides as I go through them so that you can kind of go along with me with the documents that we provided you. You can see by the cover there's a couple of books out there. My first was ROI Selling. This is really about the first half of our presentation today. And the second half is based on, it's based on The Key to the C-Suite, which is my latest book. It came out in June of last year. It actually hit number 10 on the Amazon best-selling business books in June of last year. So it's a very, very good book. I highly recommend both of these. The Key to the C-Suite picks up right where ROI Selling leaves off. So they're really very complementary of each other as well. Let me begin with our objectives. The first thing that we want to make sure we help you with today is to help you define your value proposition. I find it interesting how people will send their sales force out without really defining the value that they have to offer. They go out and they ask questions, right? I mean, that's how we do our discovery. We go out and we ask people about their issues, pains, and goals. Well, isn't it interesting that you have multiple salespeople asking multiple questions that in some cases aren't even related to each other? So how do you get to the same value proposition asking different questions? So one of the things that we want to help you with is to, one, define your value proposition, and two, create the questions that drive people back to that value proposition. It'll be a more consistent message. It'll be a more consistent questioning process, and you're going to get a lot more data out of your discovery when everybody's asking the same questions in your sales force. So big key today is to make sure you understand your value proposition by the time you get off this call. Second, communicating value to the C-suite. This is a lot of what The Key to the C-suite is about. People in the C-suite, these managers, these, you know, CFO, CEO, CIO, CTO, they think differently. They think more globally in the organization. So when a decision is made on the shop floor, that shop floor manager makes that decision based on their world. When a decision is made in the boardroom or in the C-suite, that decision is based on their world, and their world is a much bigger view of the corporation and the organization. And I can guarantee you going forward, you're going to find a lot of CFOs involved in a lot of decisions. Very few decisions today, strategic buying decisions in the B2B complex world, are going to be made by an individual. They're going to typically be made by a team. Finally, help you develop some discovery questions. I'm going to teach you by the end of this session how to develop good questions that drive people to pain. And that's a really key to one of our major objectives here. But bear with me. Like I said, it'll be about 20 minutes into this when we get to that point. And then finally, creating and presenting a business case. I think the old world of the proposal has changed. I think that it has moved to a more business case type environment, where you need more information than just price and value and things like that. Our friend Jeff Gittimer once wrote, "Why do people buy is a billion times more important than how do I sell?" Which brings us to where we want to begin. Step one of our process today is on slide number 4. This is a sample of a value inventory. And it's very simple. It's an inventory of the value that you have to sell. You can see it starts out with why buy. This is about emotions, why people buy and their emotional state. The business issue, pain, or goal is something more measurable because, remember, at the end of the day, what we want to do is measure value when we deliver it. Third is desired outcome. I'll explain that in great detail, but it's essentially the third bite at the apple, so to speak. It says, look, you told me why to buy. You told me what your business issue is. Now, what do you really want? What's your true desired outcome? finally, the solution. Notice in those first three columns, we never ask you about your product. We want you to put yourself in your customer's shoes and talk about the customer's issues, pains, and goals, not so much what your solution is. The fifth column is our stakeholder. One of the cool things about our stakeholder column is that it ties people to problems and people to solutions, which is really kind of a neat concept when you think about it. If I'm new or I'm a new hire, for example, or I'm an investor in your company, this gives me an opportunity to see who you're selling to and what problems you're solving. Finally, your solution has to do one of three things: reduce a cost, avoid a cost, or increase revenue. Again, I'll get into these in more detail in a moment. The second to last column is the value metric. That metric is essentially what cost you're reducing, what revenue you're increasing, or what cost you're avoiding. Now, if I don't say it in a little while, I'll make sure I say it now, is that your solution could solve multiple issues. Your solution could reduce cost and avoid cost at the same time, or reduce cost and increase revenue at the same time. And you'll see instances where that could occur. And then finally, a value statement is essentially just repeating that line in one sentence. There's additional columns that we added in our business because this is one of the workshops that we provide as an organization at ROI for Sales. What I'm trying to help you with is something that you can do on your own, or you could, of course, you know, shameless plug for ROI for Sales, you could hire us to come in and do this for you. So why do we want a value inventory? I get this question all the time. First of all, it's one of those things that you have to know your value to be able to articulate your value. I mean, think about this. If I went into your organization and say you had 40 salespeople and I said, what's your value proposition to each of the 40? I suspect I'd get probably at least 20 to 40 different answers. So one of the things that the value inventory does for us is it outlines all your value propositions and it gives you the ability to understand them in a way that you'll be able to articulate them later. The second thing is to help you understand the emotion behind decision makers. You know, I still believe that in this world we do make decisions based on emotion and then we come back and try to justify with logic. There's a lot of emotional buying out there. I mean, it may not seem like it because of how difficult it is to sell in today's environment, but there's still some emotion behind it. People buy from people. If they like you, they're going to try to find a way to buy from you, and that's where the rest of your value proposition becomes important, is you need to be able to articulate it to give your buyer ammunition to sell within the organization. The third thing I mentioned earlier, and I'll continue to mention it throughout the webcast or the telecast today, is to drive a consistent value message. One of those issues that I find in every organization I deal with, and we deal with companies from all sizes, from startups all the way through, say, an Ingersoll Rand, which is a $12 to $15 billion company, or even HP, is that your message isn't consistent from your sales force. It's very, very important to drive a consistent message. One of the things, if you think back, any of you that are old enough to think back, when IBM was Big Blue and everybody wore the blue shirts and the ties and things like that, white shirts and ties, rather, their message was very, very consistent. And that was, they spent a lot of money teaching their sales force to drive a consistent message. Dell's another one with great consistent messaging. Your entire organization gets onto the same page if you do a value inventory within the organization. This is an opportunity to bring customer-facing individuals together into one room and discuss the issues, pains, and goals, the desired outcomes, and the reasons that people buy from you. You bring in marketing people and salespeople and perhaps support, management, executives, and so forth. Build confidence and value. This is one of those things that we actually tripped upon. I would never have thought of this on my own, but a company that was a startup, we've had this happen several times, but the one that started this was a company was a startup, and they were still trying to understand and define their value, and they put themselves in their few customers' shoes, and they came back and said, you know, that's a great value prop. That's a great value prop. And before you knew it, everybody in the room was behind it, and they were like, wow, we didn't even realize we had all these values. So it's really important that if we can define these values well and we drive a consistent message, that we're going to build some confidence in your sales force about your value proposition. And then our last reason for a value inventory, and there are several, but these are the ones that jumped off a page for you, is the value drives the C-suite metrics. And what those are is in my book, The Key to the C-Suite, I start the book out with 14 or so metrics that are key to strategic buying decisions. They are the types of metrics that the C-suite looks at when they are making these types of decisions. They do things like take a look at their debt to equity. They may look at their operating cost, cash flow. Cash flow, cash is king. They want to know if you affect their cash flow. So these are just a few of them. I'm going to go into this in great detail in a little while. So bear with me. Slide number 6 I realize there's 52, but I'm going to work through these very quickly. Slide number 6 is a worksheet for you, something you should have printed out, hopefully, and it gives you a place to write some things down. So as I go through this, I'd like you to start jotting a few things down as well. If you're listening to this in the car, then don't jot anything down. Use Siri on your iPhone and say it or something. But our template here has 4 columns, why buy, issue or business issue, pain or goal, and then desired outcome, and finally the stakeholder. This is a little bit different order than we showed you a moment ago, but we mix them up a little bit just to keep you on your toes. So our first column is why buy. And let me start with slide number 8 is an example, so you can kind of look at this. Let me set this up with the type of company that filled out these 3 items on the why buy here. This is a company that sells software to tax accountants to do taxes. So their customers are people like me, businesses, individuals, corporations, and they come to these companies to have them do their taxes. And this is the company that sells to the companies that do taxes. So it's tax software, essentially. Why buy? This is the foundation for all your value. Because, again, I still believe that people buy on emotion and justify with logic. So we want to be emotional in this first column. We want you to put yourself in your customer's shoes. Begin your sentence in here with I or we. Personalize it. So pretend that you are the CEO, CFO, whomever you might be. And then make sure that you begin your sentence with I or we. This is a way that we can help understand your buyer and your market from different views. And the reason I say this is that, remember, bring in your marketing, bring in your sales, bring in your client services, executives, management, things like that. And so you're getting a different view of why they think the person that they deal with at the customer's organization would buy from you. So it gives you a different kind of a view here. And finally, it helps us understand trends. And trends being, the point being that if you put yourself in your customer's shoes, you have an opportunity to better understand what the market's doing. So let me read a couple of these off just to give you a little feel for this. Oh, incidentally, make it simple. Just be simple. No more than 10 words. Whatever comes off your mind, this is just kind of a throwing stuff against the wall to see what sticks. So be emotional. Start with I or we. First one is I need to complete tax returns faster. The second one is, I need to increase the accuracy of the tax returns. And the third one we wrote down as our example is, I need to improve client services. So why buy is all about emotion. Remember, stay within your job description. This is how we get the different points of view, by you in marketing giving us your view, and you in sales giving us yours, and you in management giving us yours. If you're still having issues with who to put yourself into, think about who you deal with, and then just be them. Be sure to use emotion. Be sure to be in with I or we. One of the important things that I see when people do this themselves, because what will happen is sometimes customers of mine will go out and try to do this, and then they'll call me and say, can you fix it? And one of the things I find often is that they try to mix too many ideas onto a line. Keep one idea per line. It's real important to break this into pieces and make it really simple. We'll put it all back together later. But for right now, make every line pretty simple. By the way, you're probably only going to come up with, what you should come up with is somewhere between 20 and 40 line items. And so, again, keep it simple. Phrase your idea as a pain, an issue, or a goal. I wish this. I want that. I need this. And again, 10 words or less. Our second column is the business issue. Business issue, pain, or goal is what I like to call it. In this case, we have to use from emotion to logic. So in logic, we want to describe our pain with an adjective, which is a descriptive word, and a unit of measure. So the first column is all about emotion. The second column is about logic. We're taking our emotional statement and we're turning it into something more logical. Be aware of tangible ideas versus intangible. And I'll cover this a lot more later, but for the sake of this, tangible is something measurable. Intangible is blue sky, like I want my employees to be happy. That's kind of intangible. It's pretty tough to measure unless you look at in turnover or something. But tangible is, I need to complete my tax returns faster. Now, what you want to do in the business issue column is to attach the word because to your first sentence from the why buy and then answer the question. So I need to complete tax returns faster because, and now I need an adjective and a unit of measure. And they wrote down in here, because it takes too long to complete them. I can measure the time it takes to complete them. I need to increase the accuracy of tax returns because it takes too long to correct them when they are wrong. And then finally, I need to improve client services because I'm losing clients. I can certainly measure attrition. Remember, we want to monetize the pain. We want to describe it and monetize it. We want to be able to measure it. We need to state the pain from the customer's point of view. That's why we add the word because. And then finally, discuss these with your group. This is a great opportunity to get everyone on the same page. What you might do is give examples, talk about customers and stories. This is a great bonding experience as well. Again, be sensitive to tangible, which is measurable, versus an intangible, which is not so measurable. Our third column is desired outcome. Desired outcome is the opportunity to stop time and measure where they are today, and then come back and be able to measure in time somewhere down the road, like a year from now. The idea is that the why buy is emotion, the business issue is logical, desired outcome pins you down to a measurement. This is where you have to quit giving them a break when you're working this by yourself or within your organization on your own as opposed to using us. For example, I need to complete tax returns faster because it takes too long to complete them. Add the word therefore and answer the question. Therefore, what do you really want? And in this case, I want to reduce the amount of time it takes to complete a tax return. That's very specific. I want to reduce the amount of time it takes to complete a tax return. Why? Excuse me. I can measure the amount of time it takes today. I can automate that process, and I can measure it again down the road and show you the difference in time. What that does is it proves that I have value because you're spending 20 minutes now. I implement something, and it takes you 10 minutes. I've gained 10 minutes per return times a few thousand returns. There's your savings. Our second example, I need to increase the accuracy of tax returns because it takes too long to correct them when they are wrong. Therefore, what do you want to do? I want to reduce the amount of time spent correcting errors on tax returns. Now, this is one of those examples where it could actually have multiple answers, right? I need to increase the accuracy of tax returns because it takes too long to correct them, or it could be because it costs us money to fix them, or because the inaccuracies are causing audits, or, you know, so this is one where you can separate your thoughts onto multiple lines if you really wanted to. And don't forget, add therefore, I want to reduce the amount of time spent correcting errors on tax returns. Again, I can measure the amount of time today, I can deliver a solution, and I can measure the improvement at the back end somewhere down the road. Our third one is an interesting one because I need to improve client services, kind of nebulous, because I'm losing clients. Well, that's easily measurable. How many clients do you lose a year? That's easy. Therefore, I want to reduce my attrition rate. Now, this is interesting because this is a great setup for you to understand why questions are so important. When you get into the sales process and one of your solutions is to help reduce customer turnover, you want to be able to measure their customer turnover up front and what it's costing them up front. So this is a real key to catching or to helping us define our questions. Desired outcomes, you want to stop time and measure, come back and be able to measure at another time. They're really the solution required to win. For those of you following on the slides, this is slide number 15, what to remember on desired outcome. Oftentimes, desired outcomes are similar to the why buy statements. This happens all the time because if you've formulated a really good why buy, then the desired outcome is pretty much the same thing. Finally, be sure to state your desire from your customer's view. What I really want is this. And then finally, make sure desires are measurable and achievable. Avoid blue sky wishes. Something like, I want to increase sales by 5,000% just doesn't make any sense. So make sure that it's something measurable and achievable, of course. The stakeholder is our next column. It's the fourth column. And if you'll notice on slide number 17, there are two stakeholders in each of the column or each of the rows. Now, you can have as many as you want, but the concept here is that the first position in the stakeholder is, who are you? Whose feet or whose shoes did you put yourself into when you started this process? The second person is part of what we call a pain chain. The idea behind a pain chain is who in the organization, after the person that you put yourself in those shoes, is affected most by the decision to buy from you, and who can influence the decision not to buy from you. What this does is it creates an opportunity for you to be able to sell broad and deep within organizations. Any sales manager will tell you, and I'm sure many of you are out there right now, you're thinking to yourself, you know, our sales guys, they get in with somebody, that's their champion, and they never go beyond that person, and that is a problem. You need to be able to be aware of who can hurt you in an organization, who will not buy from you, and who's affected most by them buying or not buying from you. So be aware that you want to create something called a pain chain. Those of you in solution selling, this is a strong concept that comes out of that as well. So remember on stakeholders, slide number 18, pain chain of stakeholders. Who are the influencers beyond the person that you put yourself in their shoes? Are you having trouble? The way I remember this is, who do I deal with on a regular basis? When we go in on a sale, when we're trying to sell ROI selling tools, we meet with a VP of sales. Then we meet with other VPs within the organization, like marketing, because marketing is always involved in our process. We meet with directors of sales, regional managers, salespeople, anyone that can influence or hurt us. And help us, of course. We always want to, you know, push somebody forward that can help us and provide them with information to make us successful within the organization. You want to ask yourself, who does my solution affect most in an organization that can influence the decision to buy or not to buy from me? And remember, there is always, always a ripple effect when somebody buys a solution. What I'd like you to do is take a look at slide number 19. We added three additional columns. The three columns are solution, category, and metrics. Solution, category, and metric. Let's start with the feature solution. The first thing you want to ask yourself is, can our organization resolve the issue, pain, or goal? Now, the reason you're asking yourself this question is because of how we went about this process. It's all about being objective. If you put yourself in your customer's shoes, then you were objective, because what you did is you looked at the issues, pains, and goals your customers are facing. And then once you did that, you said, gee, can I solve this? What do I have to solve this problem? What is our solution? So what you want to enter into this column is, again, be simple. If it's a module or a specific feature or a solution of your – it could be a total application of some sort. But what you want to be able to do here is to enter the solution to the problem. Be as specific as you'd like. This is a column that you probably want to help with you probably want to define to help your new hires understand what your solutions are. So you can see from our example on slide number 22 where I need to complete tax returns faster because it takes too long to complete them. Therefore, I want to reduce the amount of time it takes to complete a tax return. What this company has that sells this product has an easy entry. They have auto prefill, and they have preloaded forms. So when they're doing a 1040, it auto prefills and fills in a lot of the data ahead of time. So it makes it pretty quick. On the increasing of accuracy, because it takes too long to correct errors when they happen, they have an auto-check feature, and all of this stuff is IRS-approved, so a lot of the errors don't get through. And then finally, they want to improve client services because they're losing clients. Therefore, they want to reduce the attrition rate. In this case, they have an internet base, they have a database, and a portal. So what they're doing is they're providing their customers with more solutions, more tools, to be more effective in their self-serve process. So it's real important that these guys have a solution. The next column is category, and this is the point where the category, you have to have one, at least one of these three. You need to either reduce a cost, avoid a cost, or increase revenue. Now, again, you can do multiples. Oftentimes you'll see where they'll reduce a cost and increase revenue. Another example or another issue that we see a lot is people will go, what's avoid cost? Why isn't avoid reduce? Avoid cost is an interesting one because what you might want to think about here is if I'm doing a task manually today, and let's say contract management, we manage our contracts or our maintenance agreements as they come in, and all of a sudden we get a rash of these maintenance agreements, lots and lots of them. And what's happening is the person that manages them, that enters them into their system and manages them and does all the renewals and all that kind of thing, they get overwhelmed. They get overloaded because there's so much and too much. So what they have to do is hire some help. Avoiding a cost says, look, if you automate this process, there's no reason to hire help. So what it does for you is it gives you the ability to avoid the hiring cost. In this case, tax accounting software, what they'll avoid is hiring temps, because a lot of companies hire temps to enter tax returns. So that's another example of an avoid a cost. Again, if you take a look at our 25 slide, the first item is reduce a cost. Our second is increasing the accuracy of our tax returns is going to help reduce a cost. And then the last one, you could even make the argument that it's an increase of revenue and a cost avoidance. And I'll give you an example of that where I need to improve client services because I'm losing clients, therefore I want to reduce my attrition. And what this is it's recapturing lost revenue. If you think about it, if a customer of ours is losing, say, 10 customers a year and each is worth $10,000, that's $100,000 a year they're losing in their customer turnover. Well, if we help them recapture five of them, that's a $50,000 windfall, essentially. It goes right to the top line that we help them increase their revenue. There's also a potential avoid a cost where they don't have to go out and try to replace those customers. So it could avoid some additional marketing expense down the road. I mean, you could make the argument if you'd like. I wouldn't so much, but you could. And I've had customers try to make that argument as well. The value metric is the next column, and what you want to remember is to make sure that your value metric is tangible, measurable, and quantitative, and try to be as specific as you possibly can. The point of the metric is what cost are you reducing? So in the first example, it's human capital, right, because it's all about time. Our second one is also about human capital because it, too, is about time. It's about increasing the accuracy of the return, so they're reducing the amount of time spent correcting errors because they're doing it right the first time by using automation that has all these pre-checks and balances within it. And then client services or client turnover, trying to avoid or stop or reduce my customer attrition, this, again, is about recovering lost revenue. It was money that was out the door already, so we like to code it as a revenue item. I hope this helps you with your value inventory. It's really, really important to build this base. It's important to have this, to establish this information. Our last point that I'd like to make is all about the C-suite metrics, coming right out of the key to the C-suite. I'd like to make a couple of points and observations as well. The first is that the language of the C-suite is, it says on our slide, and we're up to slide 29, that it's a new language in the C-suite. It's not really a new language as much as it is a new language to sales professionals. This is a language that sales professionals typically don't speak in. They talk in terms of labor cost reductions, human capital reductions, inventory changes, things like that. They're very specific, very targeted. In the C-suite, they talk about things like cash flow. They talk about operating costs. They talk about return on asset, return on equity. These are terms and metrics that you need to learn. We define them right up front in in the key to the C-suite. It's in chapter one, page one, where we define them. So it's one of those things that I strongly, strongly recommend that you pick up a book and learn some of these metrics. And then the next slide, slide number 30, I'm going to give you some of those, and I'll go to that in just a moment. The other C-suite things is that it's all about economic impact. What it means is that the C-suite's looking at the global view of your impact. They're saying, if I spend this amount of money, what is the impact going to be, the economic impact going to be on, say, my financials? What's it going to be on our annual report? What's it going to be on our cash flow? So they're looking at a global view of the organization to spend this type of money, any type of money, on, quote, solutions for specific departments or groups or individuals. This is about driving decisions through metrics, and those metrics I'll define in one more second. Each buyer may have different metrics, so it's important that you understand that not every metric is a financial metric. So, for example, on slide 30 again, we're looking at metrics like net and gross profit. So think about your solution in the terms of, can I affect net and gross profit? Or operating costs. You're golden. I mean, this is one of those things that if you can help reduce operating costs, that's really important to companies. Debt to equity. What is my debt to my equity? What is my return on equity when I put money into an organization, when I put investments into an organization? Return on asset. What did I do with my assets? How am I amortizing them? What do I affect? I mean, you think about the banking industry where they had those bank readers, those check readers. Those are assets that are just going by the wayside, but they're still amortizing them. And they're dead assets or ghost assets, I believe they call them. Turnover ratio. And this can be used in two instances. What is the turnover of my customers? What is the turnover of my employees? And again, we'll discuss some of these in a moment. Cash flow. You can affect cash flow. You are golden. I mean, there is always a need for cash within an organization. Payroll as a percentage of sales. This is something that every organization looks at. Revenue per employee. You could actually reverse that number and figure out how much revenue a company does by just using industry averages from a company called SageWorks. If you look that up in Google, it's SageWorks. I think it's SageWorks.com. But they do these averages by industry, and one of those is revenue per employee. EBITDA, earnings before interest and taxes. Earnings, much like net and gross profit. And then finally, attrition ratio. That's very much like turnover ratio. I think turnover was employees and attrition was customers. So you'll notice on slide 31 where we apply these C-suite metrics. So for example, in our first column where we want to reduce the amount of time it takes to complete a tax return, we're going to reduce the cost, and that cost is human capital. If I can reduce my labor cost, I can improve my net profit and gross profit. I can improve my cash flow because I'm spending less on human capital every week or month. My return on equity, because I'm decreasing operating cost, that will help me reduce my return on equity or improve my return on equity. Finally, operating costs, cash flow, or payrolls and operating costs, part of doing business. If I can reduce it, I can affect my bottom line. Payroll is a percentage of sales. Obviously, if I reduce payroll, it's going to help improve the ratio between payroll and sales. And you can read each of these. I don't need to read them for you, but you get the idea that by adding the C-suite effect to the last column, you now understand that when you're on the shop floor, you can talk about things like human capital reductions and reducing customer attrition. When you're in the C-suite, you can talk about things like gross profit, net profit, cash flow, and operating costs. So important to understand what these metrics mean, important to be able to understand how to use those in conversation, and I'll give you some examples here in just a moment. Neil Rackham, our friend that wrote Spin Selling over 30 years ago, I believe, wrote that questions are the most effective form of verbal behavior you can use to persuade. Neil Rackham wrote this a long, long time ago, and you know, no words were so ever true. I think that creating discovery questions will help you inform, educate, and persuade your buyer. They're going to help you drive consistent data gathering within your organization. And again, if you can drive consistent data gathering, then you're sending everybody towards the same goal of helping them understand and articulate your value. They help you define the current situation. I'm a strong, strong believer that if a customer doesn't understand their current situation and doesn't understand the cost of that current situation, then they're rarely going to make a decision to buy something from you. So it's real important to understand what's the issue, pain, or goal, and what's the current cost of that issue, pain, or goal. By asking the certain questions and good quality discovery questions, they help you drive value calculations. And I'm going to give you an example of that in a minute. I'll demonstrate that shortly. And then finally, it shifts the paradigm from being a salesman to a much, much more consultative approach. So it helps you move from just being the sales guy by asking the right questions in the right way. It drives you to becoming a more consultative expert in that field. So let's look at how to develop these questions. This is the part that's fun. This is the part that I think you'll get a lot out of. So if you stuck with me this long, this is the good stuff. Let me start with one line. I need to complete tax returns faster because it takes too long to complete them. Therefore, I want to reduce the amount of time it takes to complete a tax return. This is all about reducing human capital. So what I want to do is I need to ask myself, if this is about human capital, how do I get to status quo? What are the components of labor costs? What are the components of human capital costs? Think about it. The first is how many people. The second is how much time do they spend doing whatever it is, like in this case, completing tax returns. And then thirdly, how much do we pay them? That's it. If you look at each line and each value metric, each of your metrics, you can ask yourself, how do I get to the components that get me to the cost of this particular item? Labor cost is always the same. It's always how many people, how much do you pay them, and how much time do they spend? So, for example, slide number 36, the equation to get to cost to status quo is very simple. It's people times time times cost. So, as an example, let's say we have four people working 3 hours per day. That's 260 days per year. At $20 per hour. So 3 hours times 260 days is 780 total hours. That's my total hour cost. Now I have four people times those 780 hours doing this task. That means I'm spending 3,120 hours annually. I'm on slide 37, incidentally. So I take that 3,120 total hours that we're spending times the $20 per hour, and our cost to status quo is then $62,400. So think about it. I started out with labor cost is my issue, pain, or goal. I then moved to what's the equation for calculating current cost. And if you look at the simple components of four people, 3 hours a day at $20 an hour, did you ever think it was going to come out to $62,400? And that's why this technique works, because very few people sit down and do the math. And if you can help walk them through that concept, it becomes a lot more effective discovery question process. So when you create your questions, your first question will be, how many people are doing this? How many people do you have filling out tax returns? And how much time per month, week, day, year, whatever it might be, do they spend on this activity? And then you want to annualize it no matter what. And then finally, what is the FTE cost? Now, don't get hung up on FTE, because if people don't know these numbers, like, well, we pay them $20 an hour. Well, the cost is certainly more than $20 an hour. Typically, burden is between 23 and 33%. So multiply that or add it to, it's $20 times 1 plus 23%, and that would give you the FTE cost. Most people know this. It's also a great reason to talk to a CFO, is to say, hey, what's the FTE cost? Don't be uncomfortable using that term. Most people know what it means, and you definitely will sound like you know what you're doing. The key point here, questions need to drive your prospect to your value. If in this company's case, remember, they reduce the labor cost of entering tax returns, of completing tax returns. So they can start with $62,400 a year is the current cost of this pain. How can I impact that cost? And I do that by creating these questions that drive them back to your value. Slide 39, let's take another example. Let's do the attrition one. We need to improve client services because we're losing clients. Therefore, I want to reduce my attrition rate. So how do I get to attrition? All right. Attrition has three components as well. The first is how many customers. The second, what percent or how many do I lose annually? And then finally, what is my total revenue base from my customer? How much revenue does my whole customer base generate? Now, in this case, we have to do some sub-math before we get to the actual numbers. How many customers do I have? That's an easy number. And we'll give you an example of that in just a moment. How many customers times the percent lost annually, so it's total customers times percentage lost annually, and that's my attrition rate. So now I have a percentage of my customers and a number of customers that I lose annually if they don't know the number. So in many cases, what they will know is we lose about 3 or 4% or 5% or 10% of our customer base every year. So what you want to do is you want to get to a specific number of customers lost annually. And I get that by saying, how many customers do you have and what percent do you lose? And that gets me to the number. I then take that attrition rate times the revenue per customer, and that tells me what the cost of my annual attrition is. So here's a real live example, slide 42 and 43. Start with a $4 million in customer revenue per year. We have 400 customers that generate that $4 million, and currently we're losing about 5% per year. So if I take my $4 million, and divide it by 400, that tells me the value per customer. In this case, it's $10,000 is the value per customer. I then take my 400 customers times 5%, and that tells me the number of lost customers per year. And finally, I take those 20 customers lost times the $10,000 per customer, and it adds up to a $200,000 loss annually. Now, that's only part of the equation. If you take a quick look at slide 44, you notice that your solution is going to do some things, right? We're going to help reduce attrition. And reducing attrition leads to C-suite effect items like increasing profit, reducing operating costs, increasing cash flow and return on equity, and reducing payroll as a percentage of sales. Because in this case, sales are going to go up, payroll maintained. So you want to look at both sides of the equation and look at your C-suite effect. So for example, let's talk about questions here. If I were just meeting this prospect, and my value proposition is that I'm going to help reduce your cost of completing returns and help reduce your attrition rate, my question might be, does the time it takes to complete returns affect your profit and cash flow? It's a pretty good question. Or you might want to talk about it in terms of economic impact. Like, by reducing the time it takes to complete returns, it'll certainly help you avoiding having to hire additional temps. It'll improve your cash flow by some fold, twofold, fivefold, tenfold, whatever it might be. So it's all in the way that you ask the question. It drives them to your value proposition. We threw in a slide number 46 just to give you an example of, and this is an online version of an ROI tool that we've created, but this just kind of walks you through administrative labor costs. And we start out with the number of administrators, how much you pay them in FTE, and then there are three lines asking about labor costs. Over the 10-week period, how much time do they spend running reports, routing sheets, and you know, completing the routing sheets, and then moving tasks around in your current management software. So it added up to, what, 120, 260, 360, 420 hours for the two people at $35,000 per hour. And it just calculates it out and shows you that you're spending a little over $7,000 on those tasks for your administrative labor. One note that I wanted to make, I read the other day about, and we did this on purpose, where the $35,000 annual FTE doesn't have a dollar sign. If you don't put dollar signs on numbers, they don't seem as big. Somebody did this psychology test that they figured that out. So, I don't know, kind of an odd thing. Very quickly, I hope you got the ideas here that I've tried to express upon you the last 40 minutes. I began by developing a value inventory, extremely important exercise. If you can't do it yourself, please call us, have us come and do it for you. We do it fairly reasonably priced, and again, this isn't a sales pitch. This is about teaching you how to do this because it's a really good exercise for everyone. The next thing we went over was tying your value proposition to the C-suite effect or the C-suite metrics. Define those metrics that are important to you and attach them to each line item within your value inventory. Thirdly, create good discovery questions that drive people back to your value. I like to ask questions that are quantitative. I like to ask questions that make people think about how much is it costing you. I want to drive pain. I want people to think, God, I'm really spending $62,400 on this task. It seems like an awful lot. But until they do the math, they don't really realize it sometimes. Step four is the business case, and this is all about developing a quality proposal. Our friends at salesproposals.com, they do a nice job of this. These are the sections I strongly recommend. We well within our tools, but you want to have a summary page, kind of summarizes the answers to the questions you collected, the issues, pains, and goals that you resolve, and some of the estimated values that you can deliver. We want to look at 1 to 3 years in summary. I think that this is very important. I believe that, yes, capturing cost and identifying cost is really important, but I think extrapolating that cost over time is equally as important. And think about this. People make decisions when they feel pain. If they don't realize the cost of that pain today, can you imagine what they'd think about it over a three-year period? And I'll give you some examples of this in just a moment. Cost of decision delay, this is our number one calculation. Every one of our customers, bar none, 100% want this calculation. We're going to give it to you so that you'll have it. You can use it in your own sales process. It's a great, great calculation. Cash flow impact, this is all about how much it costs you versus the value that you expect to get back. Whether that value that comes back to you is in revenue increases or cost reductions or perhaps even cost avoidances, cash flow impact is a key. The C-suite effect. I know this isn't effective on everyone, and I preface this entire teleseminar on the concept that says, hey, this is for people that sell B2B. It's for people that sell complex solutions. If you sell a complex solution, the C-suite's important, and the C-suite effect is equally as important. And finally, categorize your cost reductions. Put labor together, parts together, inventory, whatever it might be. So real important. If you're following along slide number 48, this is a summary page, and it's a graphical summary page. I suggest using both text and graphical. You'll notice on the left we break their investment out. It shows you that the client cost is 59% of the entire investment. 33% is in user costs. It's just the way this company happens to break down their investments. The savings, look at the expense reductions and revenue increases. Clearly, they're hoping a lot more on the revenue side. If you look at costs down below that one, it's current versus revised. This is a very, very effective chart. This is one of those charts I strongly recommend that you use in your sales process as well. Chart the cost over the 3 years. That's the gold line. And what it does is it says, look, if you do nothing, your cost is going to go from $2,560,000 to $2,780,000. Whereas under our system, if you purchase from us, and this is what ABC Solutions is saying, is that the revised cost from $2,560,565 is going to drop to $2,650,281. And you can see in the lines that they're going to begin to separate a little bit more and a little bit more the further that you go out. Our second example, I love this one. This is minutes saved perform. And you all probably recognize the 1040 in there. That's 10 minutes saved on a 1040. Now think about this. If they can save 10 minutes on a 1040 and 10 minutes on each of these forms across there, this is a relatively good-sized accounting firm that they're dealing with. You're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of savings by just saving 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, because that 10 minutes multiplied times the 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 forms that they complete every year adds up very, very quickly. You can see in the lower left-hand corner that their current cost per return, this is on an average, they just average them across, was $302 to complete a return, whereas their revised cost is $269 per return. Again, if you're doing thousands of returns, the difference between that at $30 or $32 is, you know, even if they do 1,000, that's $32,000. Just in the time it takes to complete the returns. And the lower right, you can see, I like this, is how they broke down the savings in categories. So completing a form, load leveling, overtime, admin labor, temporary help, and meetings, you can see that 43% of the savings comes from reducing the time it takes to complete a form. And load leveling, what that means in this world, for those of you that don't know, is essentially, are you having high paid experts doing tasks like a 1040 when they shouldn't have to. So you're overpaying to have the work done. It increases your cost per form is why. Simple cash flow, all this does is it says, look, here's your investment from year one through the 3 years. Here's the expected return each year, and then a net each year, and then finally the cumulative return. In this case, it's a $1.6 million saving, almost $1.7 million. We break it out by year to show you, you know, in bar charts. You could do this with a line chart just as easily, and it'll actually show you the payback period if you do it with a line chart. And finally, the one that everybody wants to get to. This is the one on status quo analysis. Love this this idea. Here's what we do. As if you'll remember on an earlier slide, I gave you a picture of a screen that we created online. You'll notice when it came down to the current cost of status quo, that was at 7,600 or whatever that number was earlier. Again, I mentioned that we like to extrapolate over a three-year period. So in this instance, what we did is we took all of the value propositions that this particular organization, ABC Solutions, over a three-year period, when they ran our model against their customer, it came up with $1.866038 million in expense over a three-year period. Now, that may seem like a lot to some. It may not to others. I mean, if this is a billion-dollar company, $1.8 million doesn't sound like much. If it's a $10 million company, $1.8 million seems like a lot. But what does seem like a lot to everyone is when you take that $1.8 million and divide it by 3 years and then divide it by the number of working days in a year, and you come up to a daily cost of status quo. And what that means is that every day that this particular customer of ABC Solutions doesn't do anything about their problem, they pay $2,827 a day. If you subtract out the estimated value proposition, which is about $1,000,004, that reduces their daily cost from $2,827 to $579 a day. This also drives credibility because remember, you're going from $28 to still you're paying a $579. The difference between the two of those numbers is $2,248. That's the daily risk of status quo. What that simply means is that you're losing $2,248 a day by doing nothing. That's the cost of doing nothing. If you're going to invest, the $265,000 investment that they're asking for is $402 a day. You have to add that back into the equation or subtract it from the estimated value, which takes it from $2,248 down to $1,846. So every day they decide not to do anything about their problem, it's a $1,846 expense. Finally, enter the number of days for a decision delay. So if this particular client's going to take 30 days to make a decision, it's a $55,392 decision. Very effective tool, very, very effective if you use these tools. And the questioning process that we're trying to teach you is by asking questions that drive pain, that capture cost, you can keep those costs, calculate them, extrapolate them, and then use them in this type of an equation. And it helps the prospect say, my decision is a $55,000 decision. I'm going to take time to make this decision. I realize that it costs money not to do anything. Finally, I'd like to thank everybody for their time. I'd like to recommend you visit our website, www.roiforsales.com. That's ROI, the number 4, sales.com. You can contact us at 262-338-1851. And please check out the books. I think you'll really enjoy ROI Selling. It's a great book on how to develop that value inventory. And The Key to the C-Suite will help you understand how to communicate at the C-level. Thank you, everybody. And, Eric, thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Michael, for all the great information today. I especially want to thank all of our seminar participants. Now, if you benefited from today's program, I would encourage you to visit our website at www.salestrainingcentral.com and click on our e-training link for other informative programs designed to help you sell more in less time and at higher prices. Thanks again, everybody.